Empowerment itself is based on a class one error, as are many things in management science, and you can see them here. But why don't we take two of those class one errors, and we'll use empowerment to help James get a handle on why empowerment is a false start, you know, under a class one error for a false start, which ends up then with a lot of recommendations, a lot of theory, all which have an erroneous finish.
Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're always excited to bring you another episode. But first, we want to welcome this month's sponsor, Seed Communities, which uses a regenerative paradigm to develop human beings and businesses by bringing an approach designed from the ground up on how living systems work and change. Most education and change management is based on transference of the metaphors of how machines operate or rats function in cages. This approach leaves most of unrealized potential of systems on the table, shortchanging people and life itself. As a member of Seed Communities, I can tell you the difference is profound for the development of myself as a leader, and how I grow business. When I found Seed Communities, it was like I finally found a way to think about things without all the drawbacks. We hope you're going to check out this great regenerative education philosophy at seed-communities.com. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion. As you know by now, usually a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. And by the way, if you want to learn more about how to work more closely with us, stay tuned at the end of the show. I'm Zach Swartout, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hey, Zach.
So we got an article for a second opinion from a listener named James Chappell. He's founder and CEO of BEMI Consulting in Osaka, Japan, and he wants a second opinion on empowerment as a concept. So he sent this article from Harvard Business Review. It's entitled When Empowering Employees Works and When It Doesn't by Alan Lee, Sarah Willis, and Amy Wei Tian from the March 2, 2018 article of HBR. So the article itself actually examines the idea of employee empowerment as a means of motivating employees. So James was curious about the concept and actually concerned about its recent applications, particularly in Japanese work culture, and wanted to know our opinion.
Well, we do have a second opinion for sure, James. In fact, this article lets us open up the conversation generally about how we work with people in modern times. The article was under the subject arena in HBR of the category called motivation. So this article is targeted at motivation and how to be more effective at motivating people. I think we take this on maybe as an example of at least four errors that we are involved with right now that move away from how humans and living systems really work. So what do you say?
Great. So yeah, so let me get started for everyone today with a quick overview of the article. So authors Lee, Willis, and Tian performed a meta-analysis of 105 studies encapsulating the work of 30,000 employees in 30 countries all around the concept of empowerment and whether or not it's associated with strong job performance, whether it had a bearing on different types of performance like routine work, creativity, or citizenship-like behaviors, and tested several mechanisms for tracking whether increased job performance was correlated to increased feelings of empowerment and trust for one's leaders. Also, lastly, they looked at employee job performance across national cultures, industries, and levels of employee experience to see whether or not leaders who utilized empowerment as a strategy actually influenced job performance. So super thorough article.
Wow. It also strikes me as an example of what we're talking about here, but let's, you know, in terms of how research works the same way, but we won't go there now. Anyway, what did they find or recommend, maybe we should say, based on their findings?
Sure. So they had four key findings, which I'll do my best to summarize here. So number one, empowering leaders had more creative and helpful employees. So in other words, employees seemed to generate more novel ideas while also feeling a sense of autonomy and trust for their leaders. So number two, feeling empowered doesn't always boost routine task performance. So with this finding, empowering staff with too much or too little decision-making responsibilities often led employees to essentially negatively perceive the act of empowerment while helping very little with everyday work. So number three, some employees respond to empowering leadership more than others. So across cultures, types of business, and different employee demographics, their research came up with some pretty surprising results, well, surprising to them, about different categories of people when they looked at Eastern versus Western companies, asset heavy versus asset light companies, and shorter versus kind of longer term tenured employees. And then lastly, number four, empowerment is about supporting employees. So supporting employees using empowerment, while it can boost motivation and creativity, can also create additional burdens like stress that might hurt routine performance. So that's the synopsis.
Wow. If you are one of our long-term listeners, thank you. We love getting your stories, but it's also probably easy for you to see what Zach and I can see, which is they are operating on everything Zach just reported within a paradigm, and they can't see it. They can't see their study was within a paradigm, their findings are, their recommendations. So how do you see that, Zach? And what difference does it make to leaders and teams that they're in the paradigm they can't see and giving advice from it?
Totally. So yeah, good question. So let's look at the core of the article as a starting point and where this idea sits relative to how they see humans. So what we might call an ontological conceit. First off, this article is about humans and their motivation at its core. The article starts from the idea that motivation needs to come from the outside of an employee, in other words, from a leader. And the paradigm they're using here we call arrest disorder. So it's sourced from the idea that the world and humans are constantly tending towards disorder, and we need to put restraints in place to keep it from spinning into chaos. So while the authors are well-intentioned here with wanting to support autonomous thinking and trustworthy leaders, the recommendations they're making actually undermine how to build self-managing and self-motivating employees almost unconsciously because they can't see the paradigm.
Yeah. So when I look at this article, as I hinted at earlier, it is, in fact, the major flaw that shows up in Harvard Business Review, and in fact, almost everywhere that advises business. It is that their advice and recommendations and even studies are based on class one errors. Jack, could you share anything about that to give our listeners a little grounding in the idea of class one errors?
Sure. So this type of error is called type one or class one errors, which is a false positive, and is sometimes called an error of the first kind. In terms of, say, like a courtroom example, a type one error corresponds to convicting an innocent defendant based on false ideas.
Aha. Uh-huh. That's why courtroom dramas are so exciting to watch.
Exactly.
Well, this also happens in hypothesis testing, which is what they were doing here. But when it ends in a null hypothesis, like, nope, don't agree, but the hypothesis is true but rejected, we've got a class one error. And that's one thing that I get most upset about research. Also, if you're using a false hypothesis as though it is the fundamental truth. So a class one error is kind of a general statement that gets made, or a default position is used when there's really no correlation between what they're building it on and what and how they're studying it. So not between the hypothesis, the examining process, or the findings. You can't find correlations. Zach, what is the implication of this for, well, humans, but also for natural systems and the kind of challenges that we face today?
I think, in short, I think you get a lot from this kind of thinking. I think you get a lot of the issues we see today. So we seem to be living in some kind of epistemological crisis where we all seem to be struggling to understand what's true and how to make sense of it. Meanwhile, most of our work systems are all sourced from this arrest disorder worldview that is designed to intentionally undermine independent thought. Therefore, there's a class one error at the core of the article's premise. What the authors, and I think most people, want is people to be self-motivating and trusting of the people around them at work. But they're using thinking that actually degrades the idea. So, but Carol, how do you see this relating to empowerment in James's question?
Well, I mean, empowerment itself is based on a class one error, as are many things in management science, and you can see them here. But why don't we take two of those class one errors, and we'll use empowerment to help James get a handle on why empowerment is a false start, you know, under a class one error for a false start, which ends up then with a lot of recommendations, a lot of theory, all which have an erroneous finish.
Yeah. So you mean like the idea is that, or the idea that humans are mammals and rat-like and can be and have to be directed from the outside, which I think gets spoken to a little bit in this article. I see this from time to time. I saw it all the time, actually, in healthcare. It was like there was a lot of talk of empowerment, but really they ran into the exact same problems with these overlooked class one errors. And as a result, none of this work really ended up manifesting in people like they'd hoped.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, no, it's not funny, but if you have a macabre sense of humor, it's funny that we have this idea that humans are like rats and you have to have this externally directed thing. All of that comes from actually applying the study of machines, including artificial intelligence, to the study of humans. That's where we started originally. And for the basis of that is we start with classical physics about machines, about things, about the physical world, and apply it to life, humans in this case. So Newton saw everything that was alive as static, as separated, as interconnected, you know, as if though they were rocks in a pond. Everything is, well, a thing. It's an object to be studied and to be affected by some external force. So, Zach, where is it that classical physics paradigm plays out here in this article?
Totally. So let's look at one of the other aspects. So I think it was number three is categories, right? Where, as Carol said, in the Newtonian view of things, saw things as separated, right? So category is an efficient and classically Newtonian way to dissect things and ideas and people. So if we look at finding number three, the authors looked at different categories of people, as I mentioned before. So Western versus Eastern, asset heavy versus asset light companies and employees, and then shorter versus longer tenured employees, to try to find some data-driven pattern that could then be generalized to a group. And this is the atomization of people at work, right? But Carol, what's an alternative hypothesis here then?
You know, it's so funny. People, when I tell them that we have a problem with categories, they said, but how else would you know how to finally make sense of it? Things have to fit somewhere. Well, there are a few alternatives. Life is actually composed not of those predefined categories, but by self-determining living wholes that have agency and have aspiration. So you, Zach, as a person, me as a person, a life shed, which we sit in, you know, and planets, which have their own self-determining work, and the wholes within wholes, like people within families, within neighborhoods, within communities, within natural systems, within a region. All of those are a very different way of looking. And you're looking at the whole of it, not the categories of the species within it even. Humans and life are not in need of external input to function, to thrive, to evolve, like you get when you have a machine view. But we default to that idea because of some of the erroneous thinking that's hundreds of years old and, in fact, still taught in schools.
Yeah, you mean like Newton's idea of closed systems, which is truly a different place to start than the idea of each human as a whole nested in an organization where each can be and is self-determining. The issue is that each person has power in their own agency, but we don't bother to develop it. In fact, if I follow the article's advice as a leader, I actually undermine it. So, for example, the article looks at Western versus Eastern cultures and offers these broad generalizations about the cultures rather than looking at specific living employees nested inside a company inside a larger system that weaves through cultures. This abstraction and generalization can lead pretty quickly into stereotyping.
Right, and racism and all the other isms that go with it. All right, so we start with everything as a separate, independent thing. And we design everything based on that. Then what happens is we get a mess because we've tried to put all males in one group, all certain level of education in another group, all careers or professions. And now we have a mess because they are not all one is like the other. And so we have to ameliorate the mess we've got. And that's because we started with false assumptions of categories with a class one error we made from studying those. And now we're in a pickle with layers of people on top of other people, cascading down powers like animals in cages who are no longer allowed to set foot outside of the box they've been defined in. The sad part is that getting rid of hierarchies does nothing of any significance to really awaken an unfolding potential, because it's still based on the class one error of things. We just got different people managing it, taking on the even the re-ameliorated idea takes on the externally structured thinking. And that's a problem in holacracy. We've looked at this before, where you don't really change the work, you change the who's doing it and flatten things a little. But you, the most you do is empower people to hand off authority, but it doesn't really change anything since you're still working from the class one error that humans are machines, they can't invent, there's no opening of whole new ways to conceive of things. We just have to try rearranging things so they're a little less bad.
Right. When really what we need to do is start from a first principle, right? Like the truth about working of the reality of a living systems view. Humans are examples of living systems that can think for themselves and can develop that capacity further and exercise it in a team or group setting in service of something for customers, not their boss or their business unit.
Right. So the accompanying, there's a second class one error here that accompanies this first one. It is and you can see how they got there. If humans are like machines, there's nothing going on inside. There's only what you can see. So they, or we, are only external objects. You can see in this article, as I think here, that there is really one error built in the other. It's a machine, so it can't have any internal processing. Do you see that playing out in their findings?
Yeah, I see it playing out actually in the third point around routine task performance, or actually I think it's the fourth point. So as the authors looked into their research, they saw employees as followers for whom a determining factor was, quote, how they perceive their leader's behavior, unquote. It's as though employees are vessels with no independent thought and need the leader to role model how they need to behave. Carol, where did that error start?
Oh, well, it's really a case of one false idea building on the next theory, next false idea, never seeing the foundation was faulty. So let's make this really explicit. We just said that Newton makes everything things. So nothing we see is dynamic. Nothing is alive. Nothing is independently able to express in its own agency. Or to even get what it needs to from the system in which it's embedded. It's an inanimate object. This is what the kind of work that Frederick Taylor, when he brought in scientific management, like study humans, make them into categories, and manage them from outside. And that was in the 1980s, you know, a century and a half ago, old news, and wasn't true then, isn't true now.
Right, the 1880s. Yeah, that was, 1980, I mean, I was born in 1980, but.
the 1880s, sorry, no, thanks for staying on top of that.
Yeah, but the class one error is as you say, of humans as machines, didn't really seem to go away even when the act of teaching of it dissipated, which is weird, right? The idea like humans are like machines was and still is used as a metaphor for generations. And it's still here in this article. So the metaphor is doing its work long after it's been taught. And humans are still seen as machines, you know, by the assumption of external management, right? And so the key to everything being a thing is all that's available to be studied and managed. So in other words, there's no internal or self-effective process here because that metaphor continues to be used and implied and then framing everything about these ideas.
Yeah. So that's the big addition that came next, that you could not so easily adopt without Newton's, this idea there's no internal process. You couldn't easily adopt that if we didn't already have Newton's everything is a thing, and Taylor's it has to have this external management to be able to make it work. So we're building on that and not the idea that people could be self-managing of themselves. The next idea with ramping, or the next, I'd say, era was the Industrial Revolution, where we decided to do this on a grand scale.
Yeah, it seems crazy that people were treated not like animals even, but like machines, right? Like in the early days of the Industrial Revolution, large numbers of people died, were injured, and ultimately seen as cogs that were easily replaced. And that seems to pervade much of business thinking. But then, of course, you had unions that arose and a new humanist theories of motivation about making a better workplace come in to improve productivity. But you don't actually motivate machines. So how did we get to motivation, Carol?
Yeah, I love that question, as you well know. There seem to be ideas that are still underlying this theory in the article here. And are being offered as ameliorations for the class one errors themselves, which this whole idea there's no internal processing meant there's no internal motivation. There's no internal sourcing of power. So how in the world could you get to empowerment?
Right. Okay, I see where you're going. Okay, so actually let's look at something that seems kind of obvious on its face, but may have slipped past without a second or third reading here. So why do employees need to feel empowered in the first place, right? Like, what is it in the fundamental design of work systems that has them feeling untrusting of leadership? Already, the authors are trying to solve a problem, as in workers feel unmotivated and don't trust management. So instead of reconsidering the frame they're using, they pull together research to try to not reimagine how routine work functions, but ameliorate the surface level problems associated with the work design. But Carol, share with us all the logic train that kind of leads to our second class one error in your mind here.
Well, that one became very obvious about how we got here. Humans stopped being passive, like the things they were told to be. They organized, they spoke their mind, they became passive aggressive in psychological language, by just not always doing what they were told to do. And it was a disaster for the rising class of industrialists, like, you know, the so-called robber barons, Henry Ford, Andrew Carnegie, Cornelius Vanderbilt, John D. Rockefeller, all those guys. They were being slowed down by recalcitrant workers. And so a guy named John Watson stepped in, told these guys he would teach them how to manage these people as easily as they could their machines. And we know his study of rats. We don't need to go through all that again. He created behavioral psychology. But less well known is the class one error that he introduced.
Right. So the idea here is that there's no inner processing in any being. If everyone is a thing, then there is no thinking, feeling, guessing, or projecting into the future. Everything we can consider about people we have on the surface and can ultimately be manipulated. This was introduced at the same time as Taylorism declined. And John Watson, conversely, and behaviorism was rising.
Yeah, interesting intersection, right? So Watson solidified the ideas that had been inside this paradigm, or humans are like machines, because he needed it to be true for his entrepreneurial venture to raise capital. He was a psychologist at Johns Hopkins. He wanted to build a lab to continue his postdoctoral work on annual behaviorism. He, by the way, was heavily influenced by Pavlov. Do you remember him? Where you ring the bell, the dogs salivate because they've been conditioned to do that. His work was built on studying everything by sensory observations, what you could see, feel, touch, etc. The feelings of were particularly important to how you can manipulate animals as a substitute for humans. So we've gone from machines to animals to do their bidding, and not even animals in their full functioning. Particularly, it required that because there's nothing going to motivate people inside their own experience, they need external stimulus to which they can respond. Then you can cement that rewarding in them, like Pavlov did by ringing the bell, and punish them when they didn't follow up on the desired response. Does that sound familiar, Zach?
Yeah. And if I remember right, he promised the industrialists he could make humans as manipulable as machines, right? So this is the core of the whole thing. And so titans of industry were so desperate, they gave him buckets of cash he requested in order to set up his lab. And as an outcome, he gave us behavior modification as humans, as though they were rats. And it seems to me that this idea has not waned in management practice, even for almost 100 years. So it's clearly a class one error that's been disproven over time. Yet I learned how to do this kind of management in business school even. So you need only look at like rewards, compensation structures, performance bonuses, and all that kind of stuff to see that stuff at work.
Yeah, it has not changed even after decades of disproving the class one theory. And in the last, I'd say, two decades, it is escalating that it is incorrect. So the humanist school of psychology, for one, tore down that error that you can get nothing to happen from the inside out. But the behavior school is still the dominant paradigm in all organization, education, parenting, you name it. So it may take us a few hundred more years to dislodge that theory if we survive it. Zach, what are your kind of summary comments on this article and our whole class one error approach to it? And what would you recommend to these authors and other HBR readers as a second opinion?
Well, I mean, I think and I hope that we're getting people on a path towards better discernment here. But I'd recommend going up a level into a regenerative or living systems view of humans and looking at motivation from that frame at a specific person, nested, who's trying to contribute to a specific living customer in their life, right? What is it that is driving the well-being and function of that person? And I think what you'll find is radically different. Anything you'd want to add, Carol?
Well, I think my summary is the reason we do business second opinion is to teach people to question, because we take for gospel so much of what we're taught in school by our parents, our churches, our military, and so much of it is based on class one errors. And if we want to get back to having clarity and ability to make sense out of those things you mentioned at the beginning, where no one knows what to believe, we each have to use that capacity to think and discern on everything we read, everything we hear, go back and find out its source, its foundation. And if you find an article which you are really curious about, like James Chappelle sent us this one, then let us know your question and send along an article. We'd love to give you our opinion.
Before you go, we have several new learning communities to do this kind of thinking starting in January. That actually started in January. A community of board members that are for-profit, not-for-profits, and hybrid boards of directors or advisories. A new cohort of business teams who engage in regenerative strategic thinking and a way to use systems thinking in developing strategy, plus an ongoing community for educators in all domains. We still have a few seats in the Women Entrepreneurs community, so please email us if you're interested at carol@carolstanford.com.
Also, to let you know that we are going to be switching to doing a once a month podcast, but we still need your help, even though that reduces some of our expenses. We would love to have you recommend articles like James did for this one, like Susan did for another one, Karen, folks we have come to really appreciate their questioning. And thanks, James, for giving us this opportunity. Email us your suggested topic and article on which you want a business second opinion to carol@businesssecondopinion.com. Or you can go to our Twitter feed at biz_second_opinion. And if you would and could, we would love for you to donate to support our production costs. You can go to the Business Second Opinion webpage and see ways to do that there at different levels of willingness, I would say, to be involved with us.
And finally, your organization can set up a book club for The Regenerative Life, Carol's new book, using an extensive workbook and video online workshops for free. 50% discounts on bulk books can actually happen through Carol's publisher. So you can find out more at carolsanford.com. This has been Business Second Opinion.